There's no subject that can get people really going and animated in discussion, maybe even in controversy, than that subject of taxes. Look what's happening. I have an amen from my little brother there. Thank you. Thank you, Jonathan. Look what is happening south of the border. There is, within the maelstrom of rhetoric and political ideology, this collide and collision of different perspectives on the role of taxes. There are some who say, no taxes, raise no taxes. Others are saying we need to understand the role of taxes in the betterment of society. Others, somewhere in between. They offer an invitation to the government to tax his own fortune by Warren Buffett has been met with all kinds of criticism and skepticism, saying that both he and the proposal of President Obama is tantamount to inciting class warfare. Nothing gets us going like the whole conversation of taxes. Well, need we say that there's nothing new indeed? For in the day of Jesus, taxes got people really going. The people were one of the most heavily taxed populations in human history. Rome invented taxes, invented all kinds of occasions for taxes. There were toll taxes, custom taxes, head tax, every kind of tax you can imagine. And then on top of that, although under the generosity, so it would seem, of Rome, the temple structure was allowed to exist, the temple itself exacted taxes. The local regions where people gathered had to gather taxes that would be brought to the temple. So the people were heavily taxed. And taxation was a very vexatious thing, very insightful. So the stakes are high in the scenario that we have described in the gospel reading today. Very high. The Pharisees, on one hand, the religious keepers of the law, wanting to ensure that there was a purity in Israel that was kept, the heritage would go on. They, on one side of things, were very much against taxes. They felt it was propping up a government and a system that was dominating them and oppressing them and seriously circumscribing their ability to worship the true living God, as they saw. On the other side, you had the Herodians, which was also part of the Jewish community, but they were what some people would call pragmatists or realists. That group were conferred upon a certain amount of authority and privilege by Rome in exchange for being fairly happy, as it were, to collect taxes and to cooperate with the policies of Rome. And they said, hey, Rome is powerful. This is the way things are. We just have to suck it up and learn how to live with them. So you've got two factions that don't agree with each other's stances and have come together, have joined forces in this particular instance to engage Jesus. Each of them wanting Jesus to kind of choose and decide for their side, support their ideology. And so they come together with one voice. Listen to the buttering up. You are a man of integrity. You are someone who doesn't pay attention to what other people think. We know that you preach and are faithful to God. So we can ask you this. Is it lawful for us to pay taxes to Caesar? Now, what's Jesus to do? If he says yes, then the Herodians say, ha, you see? To the Pharisees. And he alienates a whole swath of the Jewish population that is very, very uneasy with the tax paying. If he says no, he agrees with the Pharisees, Herodians, and therefore puts not only those who would follow him, but others into serious peril, because he is indeed counseling sedition, undermining the empire. So what's he to do? Trapped. They've got him, right? Tricked him, backed him into a corner. We know because we've read the story and we've read ways in which Jesus engages situations like these that you can't back Jesus into a corner. These people should know better. With his wisdom and his desire to use this as a teaching moment that has far-reaching ramifications for their life, for faith, and for God's primacy, Jesus offers a little wisdom through a gesture. What does he say? Show me a coin. Now that little request may seem very innocuous. But remember by the introduction of the reading, I said that they're in the temple area. So I don't know if it's Pharisees, Herodians, whoever, reaching to their pouch that they would carry and take out a denarius, a unit of currency. If you would just look at your worship bulletin, I don't know where mine's gone, on the front cover, that is a copy of an actual archaeological find of a coin very similar to what they would have pulled out of that pouch. Through each reign, all of the Caesars would have coins reissued in their image and their name. During this time when Jesus is engaging them, sometime between when Tiberius was ruling, 14 and 37 AD, they would have pulled out a coin. On one side would have been marked the inscription, Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. Flip the coin over and you would see the inscription. You can just barely make it out there in Latin. Pontifex Maximus. High or chief priest. So in other words, the Caesar was giving himself, was arrogating to his own title, divineship or godly status, as well as high priestly status. So this Caesar rules over everything political, everything economic, and everything religious. In other words, was claiming for himself the ultimate role in the universe. That's what the coin says. So when they pull it out of their pouch and show it to Jesus, by that very act, they're already in contravention of the very thing, especially the Pharisees, that they have claimed they're upset about. Because it is an act of idolatry to bring the image and all that goes behind it, one who claims to be God of the universe, into the temple, where they worship the only true God. So Jesus indeed has, by that simple gesture, caused them to fall into an indictment of their own practice. That's why he calls them hypocrites. You claim you do not want to tarnish the reputation and image of God, and here you are walking around with coins that demonstrate your allegiance to one who is a counterpart, who is vying for supremacy with God, or in their own mind. So Jesus follows that gesture on, having already caused them. That's why at the end of it, it says they were amazed. That word in Greek is more than just amazed. Oh, wow. They're so struck to the core, is what it means. Because they realize, my goodness, there's more to this than we had come to trick him about. But Jesus goes on to say a phrase that has caused great hardship and all kinds of interpretations in the Christian community that has led to some serious complications, both in theology and the way in which the church is at liberty to offer critique in the world. Jesus says, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and unto God what is God's. That term that he uses is actually a term of economic relationship, of profound relationship. Give back, pay back to Caesar. Give Caesar what is Caesar's, give to God what is God's. But when you think about it then, think about what is the meaning underneath this phrase. If indeed we're talking about the true and living God, and what we might call opposer God, one who is pretending to be God, Caesar Augustus, claiming the title for himself as God of the universe, high priest of all that there is in religion. Now, which one is real? Which one is real? It is a choice between God, the real one, or opposer. That's what Jesus is saying. What the church has done in many corners over the years is to interpret this, or to use this, one of the prominent interpretations, as a justification of the separation of church and state. I hate to tell you, but before that particular doctrine, civic doctrine, was around, this text was around. And it's very interesting that what most people forget is that within the United States, as the founding fathers sought to separate the state from the church and the church from the state, it was primarily so that the state would not direct or interfere in the life of religious communities. It has been interpreted to mean that the church must not comment on things secular, political. You're not to speak about that from the pulpit. Deal with religious and spiritual things and don't mix up in political, economic stuff. Nothing could be further from the intention of Jesus. We think also in our own country of Canada that that separation of church and state is not our doctrine, as it were. We have borrowed it and appropriated it. That is something that was constructed in the United States. In Canada, the very church in which we are a part of, the denomination of the United Church, was enacted, was created and founded by an act of Parliament. The challenge for us is to look underneath this text and the significance of it, and to see that Jesus is providing a far more reaching, provocative reality than we can imagine. Jesus is saying, not divide yourself somehow in quarters or fifths or whatever and give that part to the state and this part to God. That's not what Jesus is counseling. Jesus is saying, I believe. Give to the false poser what he deserves. And give to God what God deserves. You see, notice something very interesting here. On the coin is the image, the stamped image of Caesar. On the life of every human being is the stamped image of God. Fundamentally, it is what do we do with our lives, what do we do with our priorities, what do we do with our allegiance, what do we do with our faith. We're not to divide ourselves and our lives. We are to give ourselves wholeheartedly, open-handedly to God, totally to God. For this poser God deserves nothing. Now, some people are going to say, well, what are you saying? You're saying, you know, we're not supposed to pay taxes. We're not supposed to help out the government. No. We're talking about priority and ultimate allegiance. The psalmist says, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it is already God's. Therefore, if our priority, if our preeminent, our first commitment is to God and the way of God, we are going to position not only our own lives, but the way in which we organize our social and collective lives in such a way that God's priorities are met. So it's not about taxation to burden people. It is about how do we covenant as a community, as a society, as a world, to provide for all people. Our priorities would be very different. Our economics would be very different. Our political decisions would be very different. Our geopolitical strategies very different if we made as a priority God's desire that all have what is necessary, have enough Now you say, boy, you are a dreamer par excellence, Anthony. Yeah? Yeah, maybe a stupid dreamer. Maybe a naive dreamer. But one who is choosing, like so very many others, even here in this congregation, who are choosing to align their dream with God's dream for the world. And down through the ages, men and women and boys and girls have succumbed to that dream. That dream that there is a counter-narrative. There is something else other than what we see. And I want to suggest to you that something about that dream is gaining momentum at this epoch. And some people are very skeptical about the so-called Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Canada and so forth. And it has its problems. But it's very interesting that this is going global. But there is a resident and a fomenting dissatisfaction with the way in which life is being organized. The concentration, even about 5 weeks ago, report came out here in Canada that the separation between the richest community of part of the community of Canada and the poorest is getting wider. And that reality is repeated all over the world. Somehow people are waking up and saying this is not right. And it's unfortunate, but sometimes that's what it takes, that people don't do it until it touches them. Very recently, the American Psychological Association released findings of a survey conducted of 7,000 American households. The study noted that 80% of Americans are stressed about the economy and their personal finances. Half are worried about their ability to provide for their family's needs. 56% were concerned about their own job stability. 60% reported feeling angry and irritable, and 52% reported laying awake at night worrying about this. Their lives are seriously impacted by this. When there is sufficient critical mass, sufficient community spirit, and people beginning to say this does not have to be, then there is an uprising. There is something that happens that challenges those who want to keep the most for the few. Now, you may say that's too political. I want to remind you, I think it's probably about 4 years now, 4 or 5 years ago, and I spoke with a couple of them because I was curious down on Parliament Hill. Do you remember that there was a gathering and a demonstration of those who were retired as well as present workers of Nortel that gathered on Parliament Hill? Do you remember that? Because of the decisions that were made to creditors with respect to pensions and so forth. Do you remember that? I asked a few, just curious, if they'd ever been to Parliament Hill for a protest before. And what we were told by reporters that most hadn't. They'd never done this before. They had never come out to engage in political civic action to call attention to an injustice before. What was the reason for them doing that? Their own lives. I need to say that there's something wrong indeed with the way in which decisions might have been made around the apportioning of those pensions. But what was significant for me is that it was not until it impacted some people's own lives that they decided to engage in protests. What happens, as Jesus is saying, rendering to God what is God, all that belongs to God, and the text from Isaiah, that it come to the table, God's provision is free and open and generous for others and for everyone. What would happen if the ethic and the motivation for us continuing to agitate in our society and in our world came also because we are concerned of what's happening to other people? What's happening to God's earth? It shouldn't have to take only self-interest to get us going. But it seems, according to the survey and others, that's what it takes. Well, fine. whatever gets people going, as a start to realize that we do not have to accept things as they are, that we are to dream big dreams on behalf of God for God's world. Because when people day in and day out are dying and suffering and under the pall of decisions that are being made by a few that impact their lives, people have got to stand up. Jesus says, render unto the posers what they deserve. Render unto God everything. Let your priority, let your faith, let your life, let your ethics, let your resources, let your imagination, let it all be at God's disposal. And you and I would be amazed what could happen if we give our priority and energy to that which God wants, what we could solve, what we could do. I want to close with this illustration I've mentioned before. The choir sang to us, the church is a building. The church is a people. The church is a children. And what a wonderful thing. And the song. We will sing the song. How do we bring the resources of our faith and our pronouncements into history, into reality? Do you remember 1989? Do you remember 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall? For 3.5 months before that fall, at St. Nicholas's Church, right close to the wall, people started to come. First, there were just a dozen. And they started to sing songs. And then that dozen turned into hundreds of thousands of people by the end, gathered every night to sing songs. Sing songs of defiance, songs of freedom. And when the wall fell, they interviewed some of the soldiers who would shoot at a moment's notice anyone who tried to jump over or scale the wall, and they did do that. They were asked, why didn't you shoot the people standing all over the church? They said, we had no strategy for the song. We didn't know what to do with the singing. Let the Lord's song reign in our hearts, in our lives, in our imaginations, in our ethics, in our faith. You and I will be amazed what walls will fall.